Thanks for listening to this Word in Your Ear podcast. If you'd like to get early access to all our productions ad-free, priority booking for our live events, and to take part in our weekly quiz, go to patreon.com/wordinyourear for more details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
You're listening to a podcast from The Word.
And we are live.
Great. Hello, well, everybody.
Another hello, and welcome to another Word in Your Ear. And I think it's fair to say this is the first time that we've had a guest who once handcuffed themselves to Andy Warhol. It's the author of the immensely entertaining memoir, Confess, about his time before and in Judas Priest, the excellent Rob Halford. Rob, wonderful to see you. And how is life in... You're in Arizona, aren't you? How's the weather there?
Yes. Hi, guys. Hi, everybody. It's great to be with you. It's a scorcher. We've had a blistering summer. And so combine that with this hideous pandemic. And who knew? Who knew 2020 would turn out to be what it's turned out to be? But we battle on. We battle on. We keep that stiff upper lip, the British. You know, we will get through this together, which
Good.
We will.
Well, look, yes. let's go back to Britain for the start of this. Traditionally, when we have guests on Word in Your Ear, we always start by asking them if they can remember what music playing equipment was in their house when they were a child. Did you have a record player? Did you have a radiogram? Did you have a radio? What did you have? Can you remember?
Yes, I can vividly. That's a great question, guys. That's a great question. And the one I remember the most vividly was over at my grandparents' house in the Birchalls in Walsall. And I used to love going there. I talk about it in my book. I used to love spending as much time as possible with my grandparents, like all kids do. But they had, in the corner of the living room, in the corner was this really big, I don't know what the name of the brand was, but it was a record player that only played the big old Bakelite 78.
78, right, yeah.
It wouldn't even play 45s.
No, sure.
But they had that. My grandfather had a pile of these 78s, but there was this dial, and as a little kid, I could remember being fascinated by holding this like big dial on the front of the radio and slowly turning it, and all of these things coming in, you know, people talking in a different language, and of course all these different kinds of music. Guys, I go all the way back to Billy Cotton,
right?
All the way back to Arthur Askey, you know. I go all that way back, and I'm so blessed to have that as a childhood memory. So that's a very vivid memory for me about
On the Arthur Askey front, we wanted to ask you, because you mentioned your first job, I think, you're about 14, you worked in the Wolverhampton Grand and saw all these extraordinary kind of musical stars like Tommy Trinder. Can you remember the other people? This is obviously something that set you on a course towards kind of, you know, being on stage, really. But, I mean, can you remember what other acts you saw?
Well, it was incredible, because that really was like a tipping point for me. When you work on the side of the stage, like so many valuable and important people do in the entertainment industry, especially in live theatre, you just wish you were on that stage. You wish you were under that spotlight.
Yeah.
So that's one of the reasons I kind of pulled away from that first job that I had as a young teen. But guys, it was everybody. It was like Doyle Carte, Royal Opera, it was Royal Ballet. There were all these various incredible traveling repertory group theatres. So every week you'd have a different play, you know. People like Tommy Trinder, some of the greatest classical pianist players of the time. I remember one guy, he was huge. I mean, I'd never heard of him, but he would sell out, you know. And it was my job, as he would walk out on stage, I remember this vividly, to crank this device that brought the mic up in the middle of the stage.
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah.
because he had to come up and say, hello, it's great to be here, yada, yada, yada. And then he would play the piano for like an hour.
Yeah.
But so before he'd come on, I'd done all my, you know, bits and bobs, making sure the place was clean and everything and swept the stage and so on and so forth. And I need to remember this because I cranked the mic up as he walked to the front of the stage. And as he started to talk, all this dust went flying off the mic. Microphone because I hadn't closed the little hole cover over the mic. I'd swept all this dust down this hole in the middle of the stage, thinking that's where you put it, you know. So this mic came up, this huge mega classic pianist, and he goes up, "It is wonderful to be here," cough splutter, because all these dust particles flying around. It's crazy, isn't it? How a little thing like that can become an indelible memory.
Yeah.
So it was everybody. It was everybody. Yeah.
But you were really, it was show business. It was, you know, it was being on stage really excited you from a young age.
Yeah. talk in the book about before I left school, I was going to enroll with an arts theatre study group kind of college in Birmingham. Got all the paperwork, had some chats with different people. And that was my initial plan. But something, just through the connectivity of life, I got this job offer as a, basically starting off as a tea boy at the Wolverhampton Grand. And within a year, I was operating all the lights. You know, I was doing the full-on light productions for every conceivable performance. So, yeah, and I think, again, little kids, when you're a child, you're fascinated by dressing up and make-believe and fantasy.
Yeah.
And yeah. I think I've carried that through even to my almost seventh decade. I'm just a big kid. I'm a big daft kid in a lot of respects, you know, and I'm so happy that I can still feel that way.
Now, jumping about between your various early jobs, Mark and I were fascinated to learn that you were a manager in Harry Fenton.
See, we're all the same age. We remember Harry Fenton.
We remember Harry Fenton.
Polyester suits. I actually bought one. Yeah. And you were the brand manager, weren't you?
Yep. Same deal.
This is a formative part of your becoming Rob Elf.
Same deal. Went in as a junior, and I was managing the place within the year. I don't mess around, guys. I don't mess around. But kipper ties.
Yeah, I bet.
And, yes.
And the big wide lapels.
Big lapels.
Wide boy lapels. And there's a funny bit in the story, in the book, where I talk about on my nights out, I would take a shirt or another item and wear it out and put it back in the bag the next day and flog it. You know, and it'd be smelling of like woodbines. woodbines and woodbines and brute. Remember brute?
Oh, certainly.
Henry Cooper. Henry Cooper. Splash it all over.
Kevin Keegan was probably a Harry Fenton customer. He looks as if he was decked out. Harry Fenton's finest. Now, musically, you're a big Beatles fan from early on, but your head was really turned by Led Zeppelin and Black Sabbath and all that stuff. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, because what a great time to grow up, guys, in the way the music was changing, particularly through the 60s, that cultural revolution that was happening pretty much on every level. It wasn't only music, it was art in general, it was politics, it was just the social strata of every kind of conceivable element of life, you know, in the UK especially. So along with that, things were getting louder, weren't they?
When you think about it,
guys, the 50s was a lot quieter than the 60s, right? The 60s, the volume went up, and that included music as well. So the music was getting harder and stronger and more powerful and more potent. And of course, as a young person, you're drawn towards the noise, aren't you? That's what attracts you. You don't want something placid and laid back. You want something that's roaring in your face. And so, some
but also,
of
there's a major connection between the Midlands and hard rock, isn't there?
Yeah, we've never been able to figure it out, have we? Although I have referenced the Beatles for this question, because prior to that, everything came out of London. All the music came out of London. The London scene was where it happened. And here's these lads from Liverpool, and they kind of changed that. They changed the game of, like, well, I mean, I know eventually they moved to London, but for the longest time, Liverpool was their home, and it still is to a great extent in memories and so forth. But I think as a result of that, throughout the country, particularly in the Midlands, a lot of bands were like, hey, we don't have to go down there. We can stay here. You know, we can get our act together in this part of the world. And so all these glorious musicians and bands started to really push through in the 70s in particular.
So what took you from managing Harry Fenton and so forth to being the lead singer of Judas Priest? What were the steps that led you there?
Well, it was a slow and steady progression. I think I kind of kicked the tires, as they say, with some of those very early bands, whether it was Tharc, God knows where that name came from, or Athens Wood, or Abraxas, or Hiroshima, or Lord Lucifer. All these bands that you knock around with as a young musician, you're learning your craft, you know, you're figuring things out and how to hold the mic, and particularly for me as a singer, learning the potential of the voice. So then we all kind of pushed forward to that moment when my sister was dating Ian, the bass player from Judas Priest, and the singer at the time chose to move on. And Sister Sue says, hey, my brother's got a good voice. You should let him have an audition. You know, the rest is heavy metal history.
Right. What did you do for your audition? Did your audition involve a certain amount of showmanship, or was it just strictly singing?
It was strictly singing, yeah. I think that's the primary factor of a band, your skill as the musician for whatever it is, whether you're the drummer, the bass player, the singer, the guitar player. Everybody's listening to you. They're not really watching what you do initially. Mm-hmm. They're listening to how well you can play that particular thing. And so that's how it was for me. It was all about the voice, but then all of the other components. I guess I'm lucky in that respect, because, you know, some people just stand and hold the mic. I'm all over the place. You can't stop me once I get out on that stage. And I love it, you know. And I suppose that was a little bit of an extra bonus from some aspects of what I do in Priest.
You get the impression in the book that it was just really, really hard work. You know, I mean, just flogging up and down the country in a van. At one point, I think you sleep in the van overnight when you're recording the first album. And you're supporting Budgie, Thin Lizzy, and all these extraordinary. And, you know, what were the big turning points that got you from that kind of relentless slog when you didn't appear to be getting anywhere to real success?
Well, it is a slog. It's like any profession. Yeah. You've got to pay your dues, you know, and you become better as you do pay your dues, or you should get better. And so that's what we did, like all bands are doing right now, or will be when we're able to get back out on the road. You have to go out there and show everybody what you can do. And that meant going up and down that M1. Oh, my God, we practically lived on the M1, you know. And going up as far as Inverness and sleeping by Loch Ness. And then a song comes out of that experience 25 years later and ends up on an album. All these beautiful memories that, well, you're paying your dues, but you're learning your craft. And the tipping point is the first time you get on a ferry and you go to Germany and you're going... You're playing for a whole different audience, and then you're going all over Scandinavia and then into France and Spain and Italy. And all of these are little tiny steps. Then the main tipping point is when you get your record deal and you make your first record. It's like writing your first book. You know, it's an accomplishment, and you know that record has potential to go anywhere around the world and spread the news about your music.
So this may be impossible to answer, but it always fascinates me. At what point did you start making money? How long did it take?
No, I'm laughing because it was a slog. I mean, you know, those early days, you'd probably get like a fiver or a tenner, and it went in the van for the petrol or to get a new tire, you know.
Yeah, but later on, when you started touring and you're playing America and you're touring in a very kind of organized fashion, you're relentless, aren't you? But did you start to see progress out of that?
Yes, you do. You do. And let's face it, guys, it's a job, and you want a wage. You know, we didn't even have the per diems. We love our per diems even now. Per diems in those days. But I remember my first substantial amount of money vividly, because it let me buy my little house in Walsall, which I've still got, and I'll never sell, because that's going to stay in the family, the Halford clan, forever. And you know, prices for property were, compared to what they are now, man, it's unbelievable. So that's what I did with my first decent paycheck, and everybody wants their own little nest, and that was my nest for the first time ever.
Who were the bands that you thought of as being your main rivals then, you know, at that stage when you were, you know, travelling up and down the M1? Who were the people you were competing with?
I suppose we were aware of other bands that were doing had moved further ahead than we were, but they were more of an inspiration than a rivalry. You mentioned Budgie, you know, they were good friends of ours, and they took us out on a bunch of tours. I don't really have that many strong memories in that respect from associating, you know, rivalry as such.
Yeah.
So I think that your inspiration comes from the other bands that you're listening to.
Yeah.
The other bands at the time that were moving ahead, which is great, because, I mean, we all have our inspirers, don't we? We all have our heroes, whether it's in the book world or the record world or the movie world, whatever. Well, it doesn't matter what you are, what you do in life. There's always somebody who you have respect for, and you appreciate how far they've gotten and what they've done.
Now, it's quite plain in the book that you went through long periods of great success, particularly in America, where I think it's fair to say you were enjoying the full fruits of your success in a fairly kind of unashamed way. You were indulging yourself in, you know, alcohol, drugs, all kinds of things. Was that because you were young and foolish, or does it just go with the territory?
Yeah, it's a rite of passage, especially in our world. It's just a rite of passage, you know. And for me, that rite of passage became extreme, because I found out later on that just because of my addictive personality and also the way my body is made, I couldn't just have one drink. I had to drink until I blacked out. I couldn't just have one drug. I had to do as much as I could before I went off into some crazy place. So, you know, I've said this before, I really miss that. I miss some of those times, because let's face it, you go for a night out, you have a glass of wine and something else, and your inhibitions go, and you're loving it, you're roaring, it's great. But the opposite, the flip side of that for me, was that I was just feeling really terrible physically, mentally. It was becoming a real challenge for me as a person, and it got to some extreme places, as we talk about in the book.
So tell us as briefly as you can about, you left the group in, what, the early 90s?
And you're incredibly honest about that, because you talk about the fact you left and actually things went really, really badly. And you kind of wrote them a letter, didn't you, saying, basically, I wish I hadn't, I didn't mean to leave, and I'd like to come back.
It was an important part of my life as a musician, because I was able to find out a lot about myself in the creative sense that I couldn't have discovered if I hadn't have taken those steps. So those two or three projects that I was involved with, the Fight album, the Fight albums, War of Words and Small Deadly Spice, the project with Trent Reznor and John Five called the Two Voyeurs album, and then the bridge back to Priest with the two or three Halford albums, the first one particularly Resurrection. Honesty and being brutally frank is what has basically driven me since I became clean and sober 36 years ago. You know, I don't really have to hide behind anything anymore. I just speak it out. And however you choose to interpret that and opinionate that and have feelings about that is entirely up to you, which is the way I wasn't thinking. Prior to that, I was putting everybody first. You go first, you go first. Yeah. Putting myself second. You can't live your life like that. You know, you've got to put your own house in order, learn to love yourself, and everything generally takes care of itself after you've reached that place. So, yeah, all this thing, like, oh, my God, I can't believe he said that. Oh, my God, I can't believe he done that. Well, I did. There it is for you to read about. That's why it's called Confess.
Yeah. So the key date in this book is I think, February the 4th, 1998, when you give an interview to NTV. Tell people about that.
Well, I was in New York to promote this tour record that I did with Trent and John Five and Bob Marlette and all these other great, talented people. Everything I do in music, it's everybody. You know, it's not. It might be my name. I might be pushing forward a little bit than the rest, but it's all teamwork. It's all team effort. So I was there promoting that, and I was just taking an interview in the MTV studios. And I still to this day, guys, I can't remember the specific question, but I just sat in a stream of conscious, unconscious, subconscious talk. Well, speaking as a gay man, I blah, 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 you know. And there was a clatter of the producer dropping his clipboard. Oh, my God, Half has just come out on MTV on my show, Scoop. And that was it. So, you know, did finish the interview, went back to my hotel room, and then the phone started to ring, and all this kind of feedback was instantaneous. And it literally, in those days, it was big news, because here I am in this, you know, this big macho man heavy metal singer, and this big heavy metal macho man world of heavy metal, as it was then in the initial stages. It was just, it was a big deal. It was big news.
But there'd been all sorts of hints, hadn't there? There was a song he wrote in 1977, Raw Deal, on the Sin After Sin album, about the kind of famous gay hangout in Fire Island. And he used to wear the coloured handkerchiefs, didn't he, on stage, sending out those kind of coded messages. I mean, I find it hard to believe. I mean, David and I were talking about this earlier. In the rock press, we all just naturally assumed that you were gay, actually. I find it hard to believe that many fans just didn't realise, but they didn't, clearly.
Yeah, they absolutely didn't. The vast majority of them had no clue. And yeah, I've often mused on the fact that there I was, you know, decked from head to toe in leather whips and chains.
Absolutely,
with
bullwhip, exactly.
The bullwhip whipping the crowd. But here's the thing about that. That whole adventure into the visual side of the band started purely out of the fact that if you look at me on BBC Pebble Mills broadcast of the Old Grey Whistle Test, and I'm singing in wearing my sister's purple top that I took out of the wardrobe because I got nothing to wear, and you look at that guy and you go, the music, he's great, but he looks a bit dodgy. He looks very dodgy, you know?
Yeah.
So I went from dodgy to dodgier with that heavy metal leather whips and chains thing. But you see, that visual completely married with the sound of the music. It was strong, it was powerful, yeah. It was potent. It had all the right visual ingredients. The fact that there's a kind of a subculture in the gay world, in the leather scene, was just by association, you know.
Yeah.
It was never, and I've said, I've said all the time that, that there was never an agenda on my part. There was never like I'm hiding in the closet with a spotlight. It was never any of that. Because until I came out, I was fearful of damaging the band. In my mind, if and to some extent everybody's theory, label management, everybody, you don't talk about this, you don't go and
hang about the management did tell you to kind of tone it down, didn't
they? To tone it down, yeah.
Yeah, they were
and
really
I could understand. It was a different world then. It was a totally different world, you know.
Yeah.
But that song about Raw Deal, we were making our first record with CBS Columbia and Roger Glover from Purple was producing. It was just a bunch of words. I don't know where the idea came from. Like all my notes come from the sound of the music. I'm given the instrumentation or work with the instrumentation. And I don't know where that was from. And again, I mean, was it Freudian? Was it Freudian? Was I like, oh, this is who I am and I'm going to burst out the closet in this song? Because for the most part, that song was just a song with some words about this place. There was never, well, oh, he's singing about this because he is that. There was never any of that, you know?
Right. You talk in the book about, I get the impression you like meeting people. Mark mentioned at the beginning about you meeting Andy Warhol. You also, in this book, meet the Queen. Tell us about this. You're a very outgoing person. Would we be correct in thinking that?
Yeah, I get that from my dad. My dad would talk to anybody.
Even the Queen.
Even the Queen. Even his dad. The Halford family have the gift of the gab. And I just love it. I just love people. I love life. I love people. Everything. I just love meeting people and talking and whatever.
Who are some of the most impressive people you've met then?
Well, there's the extremes, isn't it? You get Andy Warhol, who was like the Queen of New York, and then Her Majesty the Queen in Buckingham Palace. That was just very surreal. It was such a thrill.
Yeah.
She was holding, at the time, a 25th anniversary for British music, and there was only one person per visit because they didn't want to pack the room too much. I was on tour with Priest in Finland, and we had a couple of days off, so I flew back to the UK after the show in Oulu in Finland, northern Finland. And then the next day I met the Queen, and the next day I went back to work. But it was just so surreal going in a taxi, in a black taxi, a London taxi cab, through the gates of Buckingham Palace. Whereas a little kid, you would go down on school trips and you'd peer through the gates. Is she there? Is she waving at me? Can you see her? Is she behind the curtains? Is she behind the net curtains? That kind of thing. You go from that to going through the gates and then going into that same entrance where you've seen it 100,000 times, where Her Majesty comes in and out of there for doing various royal protocol. And then you're in this big entrance and you're going up the stairs and they're going into this room and they give you a badge. And then you see these people and then the equerry says, would you like to meet Her Majesty? Oh, yes, please. And then she's standing in front of you. It's just mad. It's mad. It just seems so surreal.
I have to ask you.
There's all sorts of protocol. You're not allowed to shake her hand, are you? Is that right?
No.
You can't start a conversation with her. Yeah.
No, Scylla's digging me in the ribs.
Yes, you were Scylla Black.
You were with Scylla Black and the Queen. Yeah. I think that's quite something. I have to ask, what were you wearing?
Oh, I had I was very formal. I had just the black... the black suit and the tie and my shades, you know, I was all like beatnik, the beatnik rock and roll look.
Right, right. Now, Jesus Priest, you were supposed to be touring this year before this pandemic happened. Do you expect to be, you know, when it's all over, do you expect to be doing that again?
Yeah, everybody is. All of my friends. We stay in touch, all of the great friends that I have in the music world. Because, you know, it's part of the substance in our lives as musicians is being with these beautiful fans that have literally given us this life, because you can't exist without the fans that support you. So we're all so desperately wanting to go out and meet them. The thing about this vaccine is it's just a tool. It's not the cure. It's a tool. It's going to take a long, 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 long time to get over this, as horrible as that sounds. The cure is going to be the vaccine is going to be incredibly important. But I think this COVID thing is going to live with us like the flu. I mean, I had my flu jab last week. You know, got to get a flu jab. Yeah. Particularly for people from our generation. I hope you've had your flu jabs, guys. Yeah,
absolutely. Yes.
So we have. You must miss it enormously, live performance. There are some incredible bits in the book where you talk about the thrill of being out in front of 80,000 people when you're supporting Led Zeppelin. There's a brilliant moment where you had to stand in for Ozzy Osbourne. Which festival was that, when Ozzy couldn't see? He had bronchitis or something, and you had to stand in and sing with Black Sabbath. Where was that?
Yeah. There was a couple of times that you do it, you know, you help your mates out. First time was in Costa Mesa, where the first kind of unofficial reunion of Black Sabbath took place. So I did a couple of shows there with Sabbath before Ozzy came out and joined the band. And then a few years later, Ozzy's sick, loses his voice, and Sharon calls me up at the hotel and, Robbie, Ozzy's not feeling very well. I'll give him my love. Yeah, he's got a bit of a problem with his voice. He wants to know if you'll help him out help him out with the show. Yeah, sure. Which show? Tonight. Oh, okay. So, you know, you do your gig, have a shower, change your shirt and go back out in your front Black Sabbath, because that's what you do. That's what you do for your mates.
You know? Like you do. So this is, so you're talking about going back out on the road again when it's all over. There has been a Judas Priest since 1969. Is that right?
Yeah, in name and concept, yeah, 69, yeah.
That's an awful long time.
Tell me about it, guys.
So I understand you've been put up for the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, but you haven't been admitted. Are you bothered?
I'm above it. I'm above it. Look at my face. I'm above it. I love Catherine Tate. Well, let's put it this way. You know, you have all of these institutions here in America. You've got the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame for music. You've got the Basketball Hall of Fame. You've got the Baseball Hall of Fame, the football. You've got all of these places where I think essentially it's just a really, really nice, cool recognition of what you've done, the work that you've done, the things that you've achieved, the place that you've been put at, and so on and so forth. So am I bothered if we ever get in? Not really, but I think we do deserve to be in there, because I look at the list of people that are in there and I feel that we have a place, and it would not only be for Judas Priest, it would be for British music, particularly British heavy metal music, and that's a beautiful achievement. You know, Sabbath are in there, which is great, but I've always said that as far as what the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame represents, the genre of heavy metal music hasn't really been looked after enough and respected enough. So I'd like to feel that eventually we will get in.
So the book's called Confess. What do you hope people will get from it, particularly Judas Priest fans?
Well, you know, an insight as to the other parts of my life that you're not aware about. I mean, I've talked about my sobriety endlessly. I've talked about my struggles in finding the comfort of accepting and loving myself in my own sexual identity. But, you know, there was going to be an unofficial autobiography of me, inevitably. It's just the way it works in rock and roll. So I just felt that now was the time to do it officially, and just to say everything that I want to say about myself, you know. And I have no real reason. Why do you do this, Rob? I haven't got a clue. You know, I just thought, let's do it, because I've never, ever been in this world before. It was wonderful, just in the whole concept of writing a book about the vast majority of your life with my good friend Ian Gittings. I have to give the props to my friend Ian Gittings, because all of this great feedback I'm getting is the fact that he was able to literally put my voice onto the pages, and that you know, I check my social media every 5 minutes. at Rob Halford Legacy on Instagram and Rob Halford Facebook, and a lot of the fans that are reading the book are saying it was just like having you sitting in front of me and you talking to me. And I think that's a great expression of the wonderful talent that Ian Gittings has for putting my voice onto the pages, so you feel that connection. So, but also, just because I've been blessed with such an extraordinary life to some extent, it's not only just for my fans, it's for anybody that might be interested in this guy that, you know, sings for this incredible heavy metal band. And his name's Rob Halford, and he's got a book out called Confess, because I'm not unique. These stories are not unique by any stretch of the imagination. Maybe some are, but the vast majority is me in my life, living my life, and just sharing my life stories.
Well, thanks very much, Rob. Well, we're glad you've done so, Rob.
And yeah, it's really, really entertaining.
And, you know, best of luck with the book. And, you know, when this bloody war is over, as we say, and you're back on the road, best of luck with that as well. Thanks very much.
It's been a fantastic virtual, whatever it is. I don't know what these things are. But it's been great. And I hope everybody's bit that has joined us has had fun and been entertained and got some more insights. But thanks, guys. I've really enjoyed it. It's a great way to start the Metal Week. Great way to start Heavy Metal Monday, as we call it.
Okay. Thanks very much, Rob.
Thanks so much, yeah. Rob. That's brilliant. Okay.
See you, guys.
This podcast was brought to you by The Word.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.